here talking about the economy, and I figured September, we got the Fed rate announcement right around the corner. The person I respect most and look to most to guide me in the economy and what's going on in the future, so much so that I moved all my investments and all my cash over to this guy. So, Garrett Norton with East Point Wealth Advisors.
Thanks so much for the intro, Brandon. And yeah, that's right. We have a lot of exciting things on the horizon, and a lot has happened since we last discussed some of these financial metrics and just the overall state of the economy. So the Fed is anticipated to cut rates by 0.25% next Wednesday, which will be the first rate cut we've had in almost 18 months, 2 years. Because, you know, previously we've had rate hikes.
The fastest and the most aggressive rate hikes in history.
Correct.
So it's going to be a much anticipated and much needed break, I think, from the rate hikes. So.
Sure. And, you know, the impacts of that, I think, will be widespread, but in particular, there will be a positive effect on real estate valuations.
Yes.
So typically what a lot of people sort of focus on is just the interest rate on their mortgage, and they often forget that interest rates and real estate values have an inverse relationship. So, you know, when interest rates are reduced, more people are able to afford homes. They're able to secure financing through mortgages.
Right.
And that creates more buy-side demand.
Yes.
And that buy-side demand actually bolsters real estate values and pushes those values higher.
Well, and we saw, obviously, with the lowest rates in history in 2020, 2021, even 2019, rates were in the 3% range. We saw record appreciation year over year, double digit in pretty much every market. Yeah, some areas have doubled in value in the last 5 years. So what's your forecast there with rates coming down? What do you see for, you know, real estate?
Well, I think across the board, Brandon, we're gonna see some increases in value in all real assets. So that includes commodities.
Okay.
So oftentimes people think of the relationship between U.S. dollars, interest rates, and what they're looking to buy. So when it comes to property, the important thing to consider is, you know, what was the cost of building this house? And that all breaks down to commodities, right? You know, wood, nails, labor.
Lumber finally leveled off. That got a little out of hand for about a year there.
Correct. And, you know, that often comes into the decision between building a new house or buying an existing home.
Right.
And, you know, when U.S. dollars become more plentiful and when money is cheap, you know, the cost of capital comes down. That's what happens when interest rates do fall, is, you know, the cost of capital is reduced. Then what you have is an environment where to buy that same basket of commodities, you need more dollars. Because, you know, economics 101, the higher the supply of something, more often than not, the less valuable it is.
Yes.
And the same thing is true with real estate supply. You're more of the expert in that
we're,
arena.
We're still in a market where we could use a lot more supply right now. You know, it is definitely still limited inventory. I've got a lot of buyers who can't find what they're looking for. And especially in the price, you know, 400, 500 and below, there, especially in the 200 and below, there's almost nothing out there. 300 and below is very scarce. And those things are off the market within a couple of days a lot of times, because there's so many people who fit that first-time home buyer, or that, you know, average, again, the average price point in Louisiana is in the mid-200 to maybe 300,000, depending on what part of the state you're in. So those houses are flying off the shelves. Still, even, you know, when rates were up, we were seeing a lot of competition and not many things were sitting on the market. And now what I'm finding is my buyers are having a hard time finding what they want. You know, especially if you're spending $400,000, $500,000, $600,000, you don't want to sell.
Sure.
If you're spending a lot of money, It's not, and at any price point, you never really want to feel like you're settling. Even if your budget is $2 or $250, you still want to feel like you're getting what you want.
Sure.
For your price.
And what's the average price point for a home in the U.S.? Last I checked, it was about $285,000. Is that still kind of the case?
I mean, it's so broad. I hate to categorize the U.S. because you have some markets. You know, we have a Florida office.
Sure.
And it's in South Florida. So down there, the average is $600,000. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's such a hard... I've heard $400,000 across the U.S. as an average price. It's like the average income to qualify now is north of $100,000 in a lot of markets, because an average home in many states is $400,000. Here in Louisiana, we're in that mid-$200,000, about $265,000 range or so. A lot of your states are in that same area, mid-$200,000s to $300,000. But then there's a lot of markets east and west coast where $400,000 is just getting started, you know, for an average starter home. So it's really more specific to the market. I don't like to put a one-size-fits-all on the U.S. average. And then again, you go to three different places, I get three different numbers for that too.
Sure, sure.
So that's why I like to kind of hone in. We have experts in every state that we work in that know that local market, because it varies greatly. What's going on in Palm Beach is not indicative of what's going on in Baker, Louisiana.
Of course. And, you know, as we both know too, the cost to insure those properties varies greatly. You know, over here in Louisiana, and I'm sure even in some areas of Florida, the cost of insurance
is a
huge factor as well.
That is a big stress point for a lot of people. Anyone watching the show probably shaking their head right now has seen their insurance go up 20, 30, 40% in the last couple of years.
Yes.
So I've seen some areas double. And it's unfortunate, because even without any claims and no hurricanes, that knock on wood, you know, we've got a storm out in the Gulf right now, but we've been pretty fortunate the last 2 years. We haven't had a lot of major storms hitting, yet we've seen insurance rates continue to go through the roof here and in Florida. Oklahoma even too. My Oklahoma office, I'm finding out from my guys there, because of the tornadoes, Oklahoma insurance is going up. So it's a problem in every state right now. It seems like insurance premiums are going through the roof.
Right. And, you know, for first-time home buyers, like you were talking about earlier, trying to afford a home, in this environment where we've had inflation for the better part of 5 years, that has been higher than the historical average of 2%.
Yeah.
And really, you know, that was the whole purpose of the Fed increasing interest rates, was to try to slow down the economy, slow down, you know, the inflation metrics that were at that point approaching 6, 7, 8, 9% during the COVID days. And so, you know, we've still sort of had the impact of that, because interest rates are a lagging economic indicator.
Yeah.
So the impact of those interest rate pivots isn't felt for about a year and a half.
Right. And my layman's interpretation of the Fed rate hikes, I feel it is a one-dimensional solution to a multi-dimensional Rubik's Cube of a problem. And I really do think it's a flawed philosophy, because you're raising interest rates rapidly in an attempt to basically squash the economy and slow down inflation, yet all your spending and everything else that the government's doing is working counter to lowering the inflation and lowering spending and not printing as much money. So, you know, what's your take on that with regards to the Fed hiking rates as like that's the cure for inflation?
Well, you really hit the nail right on the head, Brandon, when you were talking about the fact that our government is still expanding their budget. You know, our federal government is still growing. We're still spending more and more money every year. And that debt clock, they have this neat website where you can check out the U.S. national debt clock. We just hit $35 trillion in our national debt. And so just to put that into perspective, our GDP, which is gross domestic product, that is a metric that measures how productive we are as an economy.
Right.
So far this year, trailing 12 months, it's at $28 trillion. So if you look at our debt to GDP ratio, You'll see we have a 125% debt to GDP ratio, which means that even if we were to take all of our productivity as a nation and dump it all into trying to pay off our debt, we still couldn't wipe the slate.
Yeah.
So it's getting to the point that our national debt is becoming a runaway train.
Yeah.
Right. And the real metric to pay attention to is M2. And what M2 is the supply of money. In the economy. Because at the end of the day, the money supply, Brandon, the supply of U.S. dollars is what really determines inflation.
Well, I've heard staggering numbers. You know, anywhere from, and a couple of years ago, they said, 40% of the money printed in the last couple of years was all printed, you know, 2-3 years prior.
And in now, history, yeah.
Now, yeah, like all the dollars in history in circulation, what is that up to now? I haven't even looked to see what that is now.
So, you know, the supply of money has slightly shrunk, but it really hasn't made a dent when you look over the past decade, mm-hmm. right? So you're exactly right. Over the past, you know, 5 years or so, about 55 to 58% of all the dollars that have ever existed in history have been created over the past 5 years.
5 years. Think about that. In the last 5 years, over half the money in the history of the United States was printed in the last 5 years.
Right. And so, you know, what a lot of people also look over is the fact that the Federal Reserve is actually a private entity. It's a private institution. And although they have a relationship with our Treasury, the United States Treasury, they are not both federal entities. So the United States Fed, which is really the puppeteer surrounding our interest rate environment, they're the ones who determine our interest rate environment, they are controlled and owned by the largest banks in the United States, all of the Federal Reserve member banks. And the largest banks have the most shares, the most voting shares within the Fed. And so they wield immense power, Brandon, when it comes to determining our fiscal policy. And interest rates are one way they do it. Another way they do it is on the treasury market. So treasury bills, bonds, and notes.
Right.
They can sort of alter the way that they repurchase these notes and provide liquidity in treasury markets. And, you know, the U.S. treasury markets span globally.
Right.
So our currencies are interacting and being balanced with currencies from all over the world. But we still are the reserve currency for international commerce. And I'll touch shortly on a few reasons why that is.
Do you fear, like I do, eventually they're going to pull the rug on the dollar? That the other countries of the world are fed up with our bullshit, both morally, economically, and you know, in with foreign policy. And China, Russia, you know, the Middle East.
BRICS, yeah.
Eventually, we're going to say, we're no longer going to use the dollar as the world currency, and we can see the dollar kind of erode to pennies on the dollar overnight.
So, while it is a possibility, I don't consider it to be a likely outcome. There's a few reasons why. Number one, the United States is one of the largest producers of oil and gas. So our energy sector is very robust. And, you know, the petrodollar has been the crux of our economy for the better part of, 100 years, the past century. So we have that going for us. We also have our military might. And so, you know, the fact that the United States as a country spends more on our military budget than every other country combined in a given year, really sets us up for having military dominance and also economic dominance. Because, you know, if a country decides to overstep their bounds, for instance, you know, Russia has decided to invade Ukraine a couple of years ago and try to expand their territory. I'm not going to get into the politics of that,
yeah.
But if you look at the history, you'll see that, you know, the proof is in the pudding. But the United States is currently fighting a proxy war with Russia through Ukraine. And so, you know, our military industrial complex is another huge cornerstone of our economy. And we are in a strong position to maintain our reserve status. because of our military might. If you think about commerce and how it operates, a lot of the goods that are produced and delivered are done so via logistics, shipping companies. Mm-hmm. And if you don't have a very strong Navy, how can you protect those shipments? How can you be the scale of justice throughout the world? You can't do it if you don't have a strong military.
Yeah. So I guess, you know, I look at cycles, historical cycles, and some of the biggest, Roman empires and former empires that ruled larger portions of the world. They got weak morally. They got weak because they spread out their military all over, too spread out. And when they lost that centralized, and then when they started having financial, because again, if the U.S. was a business, it'd be bankrupt already. Because we're, like you said, we're spending at an absolutely just like disproportionate rate to what we're earning. You know, at what point could that, you know, finally catch up, because they can't keep raising the debt ceiling and they can't keep kicking the can down the road, and we get into a situation where, you know, all these treasuries, you know, that, because again, they just keep renewing it, QE. How long can they keep this broken cycle going of just printing and refinancing the debt over and over again?
Well, that's a great question, and I think it stems back to 1971 when the U.S. left the gold standard, right? Because that was really our only tie to keep our currency tied to a metal or a item with intrinsic value. So, you know, the United States dollar has been a fiat currency since 1971, and the only currency left in a developed economy that is not fiat is actually the British pound, because it's linked to pound sterling silver.
Okay.
And so, you know, the pound has had a lot of stability because of that, but the United States dollar, if things continue, what we'll see is the business cycle continue to compress. So over time, Brandon, you know, you mentioned cycles earlier. Over time, a business cycle was thought to last typically 10 to 15 years. That has since compressed. And you'll notice that as this runaway train continues to gain momentum, as our economy continues to, for lack of a better words, be addicted to cheap money,
right,
and, you know, debt financing, a low cost of capital to finance our expansion, what you'll find is that cycle will last maybe 5 years, just like it has over the past 5 years. You know, we went through a period of QE during COVID times,
right,
to stimulate the economy, and then we had a few short years of a pause. Now we're back to restrictive monetary policy. And so, you know, I foresee that cycle really being a lot higher in frequency, meaning, you know, much more compressed.
Yeah. So, you know, we've seen, obviously, the, like you said, the COVID, cheap money, QE. Now we're in the, you know, the complete opposite, where we've been hiking rates. Fed is saying a quarter. I'm hearing rumors of maybe 0.5%. What are the kind of chances that we could get 0.5% cut?
So I can't assign any probabilities because I'm not a part of those Federal Reserve, you know, the Federal Open Market Committee meetings. But my gut is telling you, Brandon, to look for a 0.25% rate cut, because 0.5%, I believe, would be a bit too quick, considering, you know, if you look historically, interest rates have in the past been much higher than they are now. You know, in the 80s, we had interest rates that were 16-18%.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, that's what people were paying on their mortgages, even.
Yeah.
And so, you know, historically speaking, 5% is kind of in the middle of the road.
Yeah.
But it's more than double what we were used to when money was cheap.
Right.
And so, you know, I think the prudent avenue for the Fed to take would be to do quarterly cuts
of
quarter point cuts, correct?
Yeah.
And that's what I'm anticipating. Now, I could always be surprised.
Sure.
The markets,
I think it'll cause a bigger rally if they did a 0.5%, because there'd be way more optimism and it would send more of a show. People are kind of anticipating, and the markets, even our interest rates, have already kind of started to build in an anticipation of 0.25% reduction.
Correct. And the markets have priced that in. You're exactly right. You know, typically the same story is true for stocks and other assets. You know, when interest rates fall and you have a higher degree of inflation, you know, the asset prices, including stocks, will increase as well.
Yeah.
Because if dollars are worth less, if the buying power is reduced, it takes more dollars to buy that same share,
right,
of Exxon or Chevron or name XYZ stock. And so, you know, at the end of the day, stocks are businesses. And one of the things I wanted to point out to your viewers is that corporate earnings have been strong on paper.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot of confusion about why that is, how that could be. And the fact of the matter is, a lot of that positive earning data has come from companies, these Fortune 500 companies, reducing their operational expenditures.
So that's what I was going to say, because every business, not 100%, but 99% of the people I talk to, businesses, larger, smaller, have all compressed or have all cut budgets or have cut employees, cut staff.
That's a big one.
Yeah, like we're seeing unemployment's going up again. And so, I thought this was, and I'm sure you saw this too, I thought it was amusing, you know, Bidenomics revision on the jobs numbers. Oh yeah, well, we might have fudged the numbers, 800,000, maybe 1.1 million over the last year and a half. So the jobs that we showed were created were actually flawed numbers that have been revised down by over 1 million jobs. And then another thing you and I have talked about a little bit, when I look at it, I've got more clients now than I've ever had before working two jobs. So for me, I'm also looking deeper at the number. And again, I'm a very ignorant person. Like, I'm not the smartest guy like this guy here. I look at just the simple stuff that from doing mortgages for 20 years. I'm looking at it, all my clients are not saving. They're not investing. Even my clients making $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 a year are barely able to qualify for a mortgage now because the cost of everything is so high. And second jobs. Of the jobs that were created, we've now revised that number down by 1.1 million jobs because the numbers were bogus. And then I would love to know how many of the jobs that were created aren't really real jobs, or government, because government's growing. Mm-hmm. The only damn thing growing in this country right now is the government, really, truly growing. And then how many of those jobs are created also are just working class people like us taking a second job, not a real career job that was created.
I'm glad you mentioned that, Brandon. A lot of those jobs were government jobs. And the fact of the matter is, government employees are not productive.
That's true. I'm kidding. I just pissed off a lot of government workers.
Well, so I'm not talking about their workload, you know, the permit office or the, you know, appraiser's office.
The DMV, I got friends there.
Yeah.
Push my papers through.
Seriously. But what I'm referring to here is contributing to the GDP.
Right.
So government employees, being that they're paid by the government, the federal government,
right,
or the local municipal government, whatever the case may be, they do not contribute to the economy of that municipality, that state, or our nation.
Right. They're not generating revenue for, and that's why I'm just joking.
Correct.
I like that a little fun. Yeah, when things are too serious, sometimes you got to find humor in it. But it's scary.
You know, the other point you made is that a lot of people are working multiple jobs.
Yeah.
And so what we've found is that whenever these, say, highly compensated employees are laid off, say a tech employee, for example, is laid off. We've had a lot of tech layoffs over the past year.
Right.
You know, they would go find two jobs to try to make up for their income and hopefully maintain the same standard of living. Now,
right.
We found that that's unlikely to be the case. And so we've even seen people work two and three jobs. And a lot of times what they're doing is actually fraudulent. Because they're working
work from home,
they're working remotely, right? And they're getting paid under false pretenses that 100% of their efforts during working hours are being contributed to that job, that role.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the companies are having a lot less productivity for the salaries that they're paying their employees. And that's another reason why I don't foresee this work from home trend continuing to last beyond the decade.
Yeah, I tell you what, I still miss my sales floor. We've got offices in Florida and Oklahoma and Las Vegas now, and so obviously everyone can't be in the office, but there's just still, to me, there's just nothing like the energy and to me going into work, you know, putting on your work clothes. And yeah, like one of my old bosses just said, it was like putting on his helmet to get on the field and play. You know, like he's like, when I put my tie on and when I walk in, I feel like it's game time. And I know I'm more productive at an office than I am at home.
I'm the same way.
It's just mentally, I'm old school, I'm old fashioned maybe, but I just feel better. I feel less distracted. I feel more in my element. Just like a home gym versus going to the gym. Same thing for me. I get a better workout at our gym than at my little neighborhood gym, or you know, when we had a home gym at home. I still didn't work out much at the house, so it's like kind of the same thing.
And you know, businesses are finding this out the hard way, and so what we found is that a lot of businesses, especially large businesses, have been reducing their workforce, you know, reducing their operational expenditures. And the first area they look to cut is one of the most expensive, and that's salaries.
Right.
And so their least productive salaried employees are typically the first to go. And so the way these Fortune 500 companies, which you see often on CNBC, or you know, name one of the S&P 500 companies, virtually all of them have begun restructuring and sort of removing some of these less productive roles that don't contribute at least what they're being paid to the business.
Absolutely. I mean, it's just simple as far as business expenses. I mean, you've got to, nobody's a nonprofit. Even nonprofits have to have money to run the operations day to day. You know, so the jobs reports have been bogus. You know, we're seeing, like you said, people working more double, triple jobs just to get by.
I'd also like to point out too, Brandon, that the percentage of our population, you know, the United States has about a 300 million person population right now, and the percentage of our population that's employed has actually been trending downward. So, you know, what that tells me is that we're living in a welfare state. You know, we have a lot of individuals working out there paying taxes, and you know, 70% of people are paying taxes to support the 30% who are collecting benefits. And so, you know, this comes in a lot of different forms and fashions, but the bottom line is, to truly solve inflation and regain the health of our economy from an intrinsic level, we have to reduce the size of our federal government and reduce the size of these benefit programs.
What about just raising all of our taxes? That seems to be the new solution to everything.
Well, that's what the modern monetary theorists would believe, right? So Keynesian economics, just print more dollars, right?
And tax the shit out of us.
What could go wrong? Exactly. Tax us to oblivion.
Yeah. What country has ever taxed its way to prosperity?
I can't think of one, Brandon. I can't think of one.
If someone could put that in the comments, I'd love to know the answer, looking back historically, which country taxed its way out of its problems. You know, we've created this flawed, like, rich versus poor, and it's not even poor. I mean, it's like middle class, and like, again, what they deem rich is people making six figures, seven figures, that are the business owners, that are the corporation owners. Like, oh, we're raising corporate taxes. Well, guess what? Every business owner is an LLC, a limited liability corporation, or an S corporation. You raise taxes 8-9% on every business out there. You were even telling me, you know, some of the business tax reductions that are going to go away this next year.
Yeah, so
results in like a 20% increase across the board for every business owner.
That's exactly right, Brandon. So every business owner that has a pass-through entity, such as a S-Corp or an LLC or any other pass-through business, which is a vast majority of the businesses, mom-and-pop businesses in the U.S., they will have a 20% increase in taxes. And that's because the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, put in place by the Trump administration, is set to sunset in right. December of 2025, next year. So we really only have one more tax year to enjoy that 20% QBI, qualified business income deduction. And if it's not extended, we will face that impact. And so all businesses throughout the United States.
Unless they want to raise the corporate tax rate another, 7-8%?
7%, right. So 7%. It's currently at 21%. That was also a result of the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. They're wanting to raise it to 28%.
Yeah.
And so what that's going to do is create an extra tax drag on every publicly traded company, because they're all C-Corps. And they're going to continue cutting expenses. The first line item they're going to cut is employees.
Yeah. And salaries, so, benefits, it's got to come from somewhere.
Right. And so we're almost in a self-fulfilling prophecy here. The Fed is lowering interest rates to sort of ease this employment deficit. But if we hike taxes, it's going to have the opposite effect.
Of course.
Employers, business owners are going to do what it takes to feed their families. And so if they need to reduce the size of their sales force or reduce the size of their workforce in order to remain profitable and put food on the table, that's what's going to happen. Yeah. And then, another thing we're going to see is corporations are just going to offshore their assets and income. Yeah. So Luxembourg right now is one of the major hubs for that. Long gone are the days when companies would go to Switzerland for their tax haven.
Right.
Or
what's the merits to living and incorporating and headquartering out of like Puerto Rico?
So that's a great question. In Puerto Rico, Brandon, you get to enjoy no federal income tax and no capital gains tax. And all you really have to worry about is local municipal tax, which is just a few percent, and then property tax. So ad valorem property tax. And so what we've seen in Puerto Rico in particular, it's a small island, right? Property values have exploded because people are...
Some of our richest friends are living there now.
They're buying property. You remain an American citizen because Puerto Rico is a commonwealth of the U.S.
Yeah, they didn't want to become the 51st state. They're like, no, thanks. We're good. We'll stay tax-free over here with all the privileges.
The only privilege you do give up is your right to vote. But oftentimes, with the way the system is set up, that's a small price to pay, I would say, especially if you're in the highest tax bracket.
Yeah, exactly. Most of my voting is based on my taxes right now, my business. I don't care about all the other, we're too caught up in too many social issues. And I think a lot of people are not really paying attention. And small business owners, large business owners, mid-sized business owners are not really diving in. Like a misconception that, they're only going to tax the people worth $100 million plus. It's not. There's so much more to that. The unrealized capital gains is just the tip of the iceberg. All the other tax hikes are going to hit everybody.
Right. And, the Biden administration, before he stepped down from the race, he was wanting to double capital gains rate.
40%.
On top of that, Brandon,
ludicrous.
He actually wanted to almost double the net investment income tax. Right now, it's at 3.8%. And that applies to people who earn more than $200,000 a year in adjusted gross income.
Okay.
And also earn $200,000 in investment income. That could be rental income, dividends, interest coupons, you name it. Even capital gains apply.
Right.
So, the net investment income tax applies to a great deal of U.S. Right. households.
$200,000, that ain't $100 million net worth.
Right. And
get rid of 1031 exchanges.
That's another huge one. You know, the
in our industry especially. I mean, real estate investors, and that's a great incentive to buy more property.
It is. And you know, for those of you who don't know, a 1031 exchange allows you to defer your capital gains on an investment property when you sell it, so long as you have identified the property within 45 days, and then you close on the property within 180 days or 6 months.
Right.
And so you can effectively continue to kick that capital gains can down the road.
And acquire more property where more people can live, and you contribute more to the economy.
Correct.
And you're helping build your and fuel your economy.
Correct. And what we've often seen is that after a property investment has run its course, typically 27 and a half years, because that's how long you can depreciate it for.
Yeah.
That's when an investor would look for another income property to buy. And so it adds, turnover to the real estate industry, exactly. which benefits everyone involved.
Right.
And, you know, when a new investor buys that old building that the investor sold, they get to start another 27 and a half year timeline. And so as long as they maintain that property, it can be, a profitable venture for another 30 years from a tax incentive perspective and from an investment perspective.
So obviously there's a whole lot of anxiety and, you know, with the election, with the tax code changing and everything. Again, I go back to like just I try to always break everything down very simply. I'm a college dropout, so I got to simplify things. Income tax goes up, business taxes go up, corporate taxes go up. We're trying to get inflation down. If we raise taxes on every business owner, and every corporation out there, isn't it going to result in prices going up, wages coming down? I mean, there's the companies, again, if my taxes go up 20% on Intelligent Mortgage, I've either got to A, lower my employees' commission splits, or B, cut something somewhere, or we're going to have to raise our margins, which we're not going to do because we pride ourselves on having the lowest rates and the lowest margins in the industry. So it's going to come at a cost to the employees somewhere. So to me, I feel like that's going to cause inflation to back up.
Well, you know, at the end of the day, Brandon, incentive drives the world. So if you go ask a businessman in Singapore right now why he does what he does, it's because he's incentivized to do so in some form or fashion. And, you know, really every economic facet throughout the global economy drives from incentive. And what happens when you increase the tax rate on businesses, individuals, corporations,
it's demoralized.
Is you reduce the incentive for them to operate, for them to take risks, for them to invest.
There's no new businesses being opened on the Ivory Coast in Africa.
Exactly. And so, you know, when taxes increase, especially on businesses, then, you know, one of two things happen, right? The cost of that tax drag is passed on to the employees in the form of reduced compensation, remuneration, or it's passed on to the consumer at increased cost. And then oftentimes, you know, you won't see many new businesses being formed because people don't want to take that risk whenever there's not enough meat on the bone as far as what they keep in their pocket after the tax man gets his cut. And so, you know, you'll see less investment, and that also circles back to less jobs, because if less businesses are being started,
it's a downward spiral.
Exactly. It's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
Yeah. I see no upside to these tax talks right now. You know, take everything else out of it, morally, ethically, whatever you want to vote for. But the tax policy alone, to me, is so detrimental to every aspect of our economy. I can't see how anyone can see any upside to what they're talking about doing from a tax perspective.
If you need a case study, just look at BRICS. You know, anytime the tax system has changed to value-added tax, like what's going on in the UK right now, that's had a huge impact on their industrial sector. A lot of people have lost their jobs, and there's more and more people, you know, working low-wage jobs, low-risk jobs, say, you know, in the hospitality industry or, you know, just low risk desk jobs. And there's low amounts of businesses being started in Europe right now because of tax hikes, because of, at the end of the day, socialism.
Yeah. Well, and that, it's an unthinkable that we really are looking at socialist, communist type of principles in this country. You know, tax everybody, take from everyone else, and just kind of equalize everything, and the government runs everything. And that's kind of the scary thing. Like, I see like this kind of scary pivot point right now. And yeah, my philosophy and what I tell my kids and make a lot of fucking money. And you need to get rich or you're going to get broke. Because middle class, $100,000 a year today is not enough to live on. And with a family and invest and have, you know, a Catholic school or a private school, you know, just the basic essentials. Look at affordability for a house. Like, they showed affordability in most markets now. You can't buy a house on the average median income of $68,000 or $70,000 a year, which is the average in Louisiana and other markets. You know, so an average household right now that makes $50,000, $60,000, if they've got a car and some student loan debt, I can't even get them approved in a lot of cases. And it's unfortunate because you should be able to buy a nice house if you make $50,000, $60,000 a year.
Well, that's exactly right. And the data shows we're basically in a situation where a huge proportion of people can't even afford an emergency $500 expense.
Yeah, tires. Your tires go out on your car.
Right. So, you know, there's a huge proportion of people living paycheck to paycheck.
Yeah.
Household savings are at an all-time low. Credit card debt is at an all-time high. And what ends up happening when, you know, credit card debt is so high and people sort of aren't able to get out of that snowball, then it just basically traps them in a situation where they're not able to build up a you know, savings base. They're not able to invest. And the old rule of thumb is, you know, before you start investing, before you start taking risk with your money, you want to have 6 months of your expenses saved up in the bank in cash.
Absolutely.
And if you own a business, it's probably closer to a year.
Because, I always went by 12.
Right. Because with a business, you need to have some working capital. Mm-hmm. You need to have a bit of cushion in case you run into a few, you know, rough months. And so, you know, people with increased taxes in a situation where they're coming from record low savings almost have, you know, no hope in hell to really be able to invest and build a base of wealth for themselves. And so a lot of people have this mindset that I think is very disadvantageous to building wealth, and that is, you know, hey, let's punish the rich. They these greedy bastards, you know, they make so much money, why don't we tax them more? Well, they don't realize they're stabbing themselves in the foot.
Of course.
And at the end of the day, you know, higher taxes decreases the upward mobility for someone who, say, wasn't born into money, who was born to middle-class households or even, you know, a low-income household, for them to be able to build something and enter those higher tax brackets, enter the highest tax bracket. You know, when you have higher taxes, upward mobility is reduced.
I've had clients from South American countries in the last couple of years, and they've commented to me, you guys are headed down a dangerous path. I've seen it. That's why we fled here. That's why we immigrated here. And what you're doing is what ran our country into the ground, ran our economy. You know, these were places where people are fighting over loaves of bread and fighting over food. Like, you know, we think that these things are so far-fetched, but it's happened in other thriving countries with these reckless policies and overtaxing and overspending and over, you know,
printing.
Overprinting.
Yeah.
And, you know, this government, you know, government's huge, but the people are small, and there's nothing left for the people. And, you know, I see a really concerning trend right now in the mindset. Like, people came here for capitalism. People came here because it was the
land of opportunity.
you could, I mean, I'm a immigrant, college dropout, you know, like minority kid that didn't come from wealth or any kind of special family upbringing or anything, but I could work my ass off and achieve my dreams. And like you said, now you get to 50, 60% of your money, 70% of your money going to taxes. What's left? Like, there, you know, like it does, like it starts to make people. I had a couple of clients, I showed my wife the numbers. I said, she'll never work. I said, when I did the numbers backwards, we did her mortgage. Client had, you know, seven children. She made almost $6,000 a month on Social Security. She had, a couple thousand dollars and Medicare paid for a family of eight.
And tax credits for all the children.
And food stamps and everything. When I added the numbers up to bring home essentially what she was earning and have insurance, I figured insurance on eight people is going to be $3,000 a month. I said she'd have to make $150,000, $250,000 a year, somewhere in between there, to live at that level of what she was earning without working. And so, like, we're coming to this place in this country where, you know, we're gonna become, like you said, almost like a socialist country where everyone's just living off the government. Because if you're not making $1 million plus a year, basically $100,000 a year isn't enough anymore to get by. So you're better off just taking a free check and taking a free ride versus getting out there and busting your ass and trying to work. Because I remember when my goal was to make $100,000 a year. And now $100,000 a year barely gets you the American dream, which is just a car and a house and a little bit of money to live on.
Well, that's what these modern monetary theorists believe in, Brandon. I mean, during the COVID times, if you remember, they said you will own nothing and you will be happy, right? So, you know, that's the future that a lot of the powers that be want. Yeah. You know, are the people steering the ship of our federal government are not steering it in the right direction.
Scary.
They're incentivized. I said the world drives on incentive. If you put yourself in the perspective of the federal government, what does the federal government want to do? Increase its power and increase its size. You know, same thing with a lot of state governments. Same thing with some municipalities, which, you know, will lead us into St. George a little later down in the conversation. But
that's a good thing.
You know, the Federal Reserve and the federal government are operating in unison, even though the Federal Reserve is, you know, a separate and distinct private entity, like I mentioned. But, you know, our central bank is really the benchmark by which other countries are also following. And so, you know, this recent dip in the markets with the Japanese yen carry trade, the reason that occurred, Brandon, is because the Central Bank of Japan was the only bank that didn't follow suit and follow in the footsteps of the Federal Reserve and hike rates on their schedule. And so the Central Bank of Japan just started hiking rates. And what that did is it strengthened their currency.
Right.
And so, you know, the Japanese yen had a 10% gain over the course of 1 week. And that shifted a lot of things around, because the same thing is true and vice versa. You know, if you have a currency that is strengthening, oftentimes the assets that those currencies are used to buy actually decrease in value.
Okay.
And so that's why the Japanese stock market, the equity market in Japan, took a nosedive at the same time their currency was strengthening.
Yeah, because it's kind of counterintuitive. You would think their currency is going up, you would think their economy would be booming from that.
Well, you know, it's good from an earnings perspective, because the yen that those companies are earning are worth more as far as buying power. But it goes back to the old economics 101, you know, supply and demand. If you have a smaller supply and a more valuable yen, it takes less of those yen to buy the same Japanese stock. Right. And so the same thing, you know, will be true here in the U.S. markets. When we have the monetary supply continue to increase and we have interest rates fall, asset prices will melt upwards.
So we need to find a positive, you know, direction. Like, you've done great after I moved my investments, my cash over with you. Like, what are you doing from a tax strategy standpoint for your clients to, like, again, if God forbid, like, what are we going to do if Harris gets elected and we got a huge tax hike? You know, what's the move? Like, what is the move there from a tax strategy? Also, you know, from investment strategy, like, what kind of pivots are you and your clients looking at, you know, if they do start raising taxes to these ridiculous numbers?
So I'm so glad you asked that, Brandon. One of the big things I do for my clients in their taxable accounts, right, their non-retirement accounts, is I do tax loss harvesting, and I also make sure that I am holding securities for at least 1 year, right, so that they're paying the long-term capital gains rate of 15 or 20% right now, instead of ordinary income tax rates, which would be, you know, double that. And then, you know, tax loss harvesting is really the principle of taking a stock position that has outperformed and, you know, realizing the gains on that and offsetting those gains with a position that has underperformed over the same time period. And so you use the realized losses to offset the realized gains to mitigate tax liability. And then another big thing I do is general tax planning. You know, if I have a client who's a business owner, which, you know, is really the area I focus in, I look at how their business is doing that year. You know, if they have a great year, hey, that's going to be a year I'm going to want to dial back on the realized gains, because I don't want to push them into, another tax bracket. I don't want to add to their tax bill that year.
Yeah.
And so, you know, I really look at each individual client and determine how to proceed from a tax planning perspective. And, you know, oftentimes I work with my clients' CPAs or tax advisors as well.
Yeah.
And so, you know, the team effort is really how we come out with a win at the end of the day. And so, you know, from a general perspective, tax planning is a huge portion of what I do. And so working with an advisor typically adds 1 to 2% of extra return in the form of tax efficiency. And okay. So if you have a $1 million portfolio, you know, I can typically add $10,000 to $20,000 a year in tax savings, tax efficiency.
Yeah, which is huge, especially, like you said, if they keep raising taxes. So
it is.
Going forward, you know, like talking about, you brought up St. George. You know, like there are a lot of positive things happening now too. But, you know, I worry a lot about the tax changes and things on the horizon, but outside of that, I mean, Baton Rouge doing well. St. George, the new city of St. George, you know, from a, you know, advisor standpoint, you know, your clients in St. George, what are you seeing with that split and how that's going to positively impact the new city of St. George?
Well, that's a great question, Brennan. And, you know, I myself operate my business here in what will soon be St. George. So my office is located right where Burbank curves into Seguin, so Seguin and Highland. And, you know, I also live in St. George. So I have a home with my wife here in this municipality. And, you know, I'm hugely excited because the financials of this new municipality will be some of the best, if not the best, in all of Louisiana.
Y'all have a surplus right now.
We have a $20 million per year surplus.
Take note, U.S. government.
Well, we'll see how long that lasts for. But, you know, when it comes to Baton Rouge proper, you know, I am a bit concerned about, say, downtown Baton Rouge, what those areas will look like, because, you know, 85% of their tax base came from the St. George municipality.
Right.
And so now that we have incorporated, and I believe the final vote on this is going to be December the 6th,
yeah.
According to the local St. George newspaper. But after this is completely ratified and, you know, the officials are put in place and the municipality is solidified, then property values will be growing at a much higher rate than average, mm-hmm. across the state in this municipality. We have a average household annual income of $96,000 per year.
Yeah.
We have a solid population. I believe we would be either the third or fourth largest municipality in Louisiana, and a huge portion of business owners.
Yeah.
You know, so high level of income. You know, I believe with that $22 million a year surplus, we're going to have one of the safest municipalities in Louisiana because we can afford to have a robust police force. We're going to have one of the cleanest municipalities in Louisiana. You know, I can't tell you how many times I've been frustrated getting rocks through my windshield. And
you know, I'm a car fanatic. Exactly.
Right. You know, rock chips,
road construction, the potholes, digging my rims.
So I was so pleased when I saw a street sweeper on the street the other day. And so positive changes are coming, but
yeah.
You know, we'll have a much better school district because a lot of those resources can be allocated towards making schools safer and more effective.
Yeah. Well, that's a big thing because there's a lot of people in Baton Rouge. It's, you know, kind of synonymous. If you want to go to public school, move to Prairieville, move to Zachary.
Sure.
You know, we have clients moving from out of state, and so when they ask us if their kids are going to Catholic school, yeah, Baton Rouge is great. If school is a concern, then Zachary or Dutchtown is another
sure.
good one. Live Oak, you know, like these public school districts are running circles around Baton Rouge schools. I know what I went to school in, and it was a circus compared to what my kids' schools were like.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, you know, we had fights every day. We had, you know, air conditionings that didn't work. We had water in the classrooms when it rained. You know, we had a condemned quarter of the building for asbestos.
And I'm sure your lunch didn't look too hot either, huh?
Oh, God. Yeah, I was on free lunch.
Yeah,
like, that's how broke we were. Yeah, I remember, like, filling out the free lunch, and I was excited because then I could use my dollar to get, like, four extra milks. Okay. Yeah, but I mean, that was like, remember when milks were a quarter? Yeah, some of you laughed. Like, I'd get four chocolate milks.
Yeah.
That was my lunch. You know, I'd have four milks with my lunch. And I just, you know, I look back and realize, like, you know, how much money is wasted at the government level in what's possible. You know, like, I had Ted James on the other day. You know, he's running for mayor, and we had some really good talks about, you know, the economy and, you know, schools and infrastructure and things. You know, like, it's there's a lot of hope, there's a lot of potential, but again, it starts at the top. It starts at the governor and with the Senate and then with our mayors and everything else. And you know, Baton Rouge, downtown has declined. Yeah, that was a big topic talking with Ted the other day. You know, downtown was really booming for a little while there. And then the last several years, it's declined.
Well, I can't say I have too much hope for that to turn around in light of the fact that they're going to be losing about 85% of their tax base. And so, you know, the same things that I said will likely unfold in St. George, the opposite will be true for...
85%? I didn't realize it was that much of the tax base.
85%. And, you know, a lot of the income for a municipality, you know, comes in from their ad valorem real estate taxes. And so areas that have more valuable property end up generating more tax revenue.
Look at Texas.
Right.
Texas, you know, our property taxes are low compared to when I do my loans in Texas. But look at their schools.
Right.
Every high school looks like a university.
And there's no state income tax.
Yes.
Texas, Florida.
Yeah. Yes. So, I mean, it's a trade.
Correct.
But, good Lord, the property tax is what they generate. Look at their interstates compared to ours.
Well, and I'd much prefer to pay 2% on property tax per year instead of 1%. Mm-hmm. Now, I know here we have a homestead exemption, but, you know, I'd much rather pay double the property taxes here and have no state income tax because in Louisiana, you know, we have a 4.5% state income tax. And where is that money going?
Exactly. You know, so that's what I think concerns me so much when everybody's talking about raising taxes is they raise it, but nothing improves. The debt keeps growing. The roads keep deteriorating. The schools keep declining. Teachers aren't getting paid anymore. Police are underpaid. Firemen are underpaid. You know, so... But the government's growing. You know, it's like, I don't see the money getting where it should go. And that's, I think, the biggest problem right now is, again, we've got, like you said, we're printing money, at an alarming rate, but then where's it going from the government spending perspective?
Yeah, there's a huge amount that is unaccounted for, Brandon. I think upwards of $200 billion per year is unaccounted for. Now, a lot of this could be the military-industrial complex on top-secret weapon systems and things of this nature, but you know, there has to be quite a few billion dollars per year of U.S. taxpayer money that just disappears. There's no trace. And so, you know,
that wire, like, just a billion of that over. I'll put my account number in the comments.
That's right. And so
they won't miss it.
You know, what we're going to see if these tax hikes do come to fruition, which, you know, the unrealized capital gains tax hike, I can't see coming to fruition. Because
that's the least of my concerns.
You know, well, I just don't think it's going to happen.
Yeah.
And I'll tell you why. It's going to be incredibly difficult to actually enforce and track. We have something that somewhat resembles it called a phantom tax. And the phantom tax applies to certain structured promissory notes or structured investments. And basically what the phantom tax does is it taxes you on unrealized gains over the course of the life of a promissory note, but it doesn't allow you to deduct losses. And so it's a completely lopsided tax law.
Right.
And so if they were to frame it on that, I just don't see how...
Yeah, it's a flawed system.
I just don't see how it could be accounted for and employed on investments like stocks or real estate. With a structured note, it's a bit different because you have a defined maturity and you know exactly... you know what that investment is worth, and it's very low volatility with a structured product, and so it's easier to account from year to year. They typically only mark to market once per year as well, whereas you know stocks mark to market every second. So you know it's difficult to say, hey, I'm you know as a government going to tax you on unrealized gains.
Yeah.
What happens if you pay that tax money? And then the next day,
the value drops.
How are you going to wait for 6 months to get a tax refund?
Right.
I just don't think it's feasible.
No, it's such a flawed. Just the whole thing is a flawed philosophy, I think. So obviously, so many people are really polarized right now with the election, from stock market investment advisor. You know, like I know where my CPA is. You know, like. What are you seeing the markets going to do if Trump wins versus Kamala? Like, what's kind of the thought process going forward? Where are we going to go economically if one or the other is the you know winning party?
Well, that's a great question, Brandon. You know, and it's a multifaceted answer. So I think the main point that boils down to is the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act. Put in place by the Trump administration. And so if that is not extended, like I said, it will sunset in December of next year, 2025. And that will have an impact on every facet of our economy. That will have an impact on every mom and pop business. And so, you know, if the...
And when you say impact, you're saying a negative impact.
A negative tax impact, right? At minimum, a 20% negative tax impact.
Right.
It also will have an impact on estate planning laws, which I'll circle back to in a second. But the Harris administration, if they are the prevailing party, I can't foresee that they will want to extend that, right? Because their whole MO right now is increasing taxes, not decreasing taxes.
They've said it.
They've come out and said it. That's what they're leading with. And so, you know, it's tough for me from an investment point of view to ever get behind a administration that wants to increase taxes, make it harder for business to operate, make it harder for businesses to remain profitable, because most of who I work with are business owners.
Right.
You know, I work with business owners and corporate retirees. And so, you know, I am a strong believer in capitalism.
What made this country the greatest country in the world.
Right. I don't want to wake up in 50 years and find myself in the Chinese Communist Party. You know, that's what I don't want to wake up to.
Yeah.
And so.
And you're young. You'll still be here in 50 years.
Right.
Or we'll be moving to somewhere else.
I'll be retired by then, but
you will. You're smart.
You know, but
you don't spend money like I did when I was young.
The other thing that I think will have a huge impact is the lifetime gift tax exemption, which right now, under the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act, is at $13.61 million for individuals, and for married couples, it's $27.2 million. Now, if the 2017 Tax Cuts and Jobs Act is not extended, say, you know, the Harris administration is the prevailing party, I'm sure it won't be extended, then those figures will be cut in half. So now, as an individual, you're going to owe 18 to 40% of your estate value in tax when you go to pass on your wealth to your children, you know, the next generation.
On assets that you've already paid taxes
on. On assets you've already paid taxes
that
on.
That you own.
And so, you know, this is being put in place, you know, and if it's not extended, Brandon, now anyone who has an estate worth more than $6.8 million after December of next year will owe estate taxes in the amount of 18 to 40%. Yeah. And so that is going to be a huge, huge, you know, tax drag. And so all of the work you've put in, all the sacrifices you've made throughout your life to make that, you know, seven-figure nest egg, now your children will have a huge chunk of that taken out to go put right back into the waste machine that is our federal government. Yeah. And so, you know, the only way to really avoid that is going to be through estate planning, say with trust instruments.
Yeah.
And so there are ways to avoid that estate tax, you know, lifetime gift threshold. But as it stands right now, you know, with a $13.61 million exemption, lifetime exemption, you know, the Trump Tax Cuts and Jobs Act has done a great job of including a vast majority of Americans in that exemption. And so most Americans don't have to pay estate taxes,
right?
Which is great.
You shouldn't. You've already paid taxes on all that stuff.
Precisely. And so if we move that watermark down by 50%.
And to me, it starts there.
Yep.
And then we move it down again.
Yep.
And then we move it down again. And then pretty soon it's down to $1 million estate because, oh, $1 million, you're rich.
And keep in mind, Brandon, an estate is everything.
That's
your house. Yeah. That's your, you know, savings.
A house that grandma bought 50, 60 years ago for $30,000, my father-in-law's house.
Right.
His estate, his property, probably had 40 grand in it on Old Perkins, right by Santa Maria, 8 acres, beautiful lake, everything. That property alone that was $40,000 back then.
Easily 3 million.
Probably a million and a half, 2 million.
Yeah.
It depending on who appraises it.
Sure. Yeah.
So that estate that was $40,000, $50,000, and then, God forbid, it gets taxed on the unrealized capital gains. I mean, so, you know, like, to look at that and see they keep lowering the bar, you're starting to tax normal family inheritances of $1 million, $2 million, and taxing them at an alarmingly high rate.
I mean, I've had clients that have surpassed that $6.8 million threshold from working for Exxon or Chevron, you know, just normal everyday working people who put all of their money in their 401k into their employer stock.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, ended up retiring.
40 years of matching, right, and splits and whatever.
I mean, you're talking about 40 years of work.
Yeah.
They retired as a millionaire, but now guess what their kids get to enjoy? An 18 to 40% tax cut, you know? So now Uncle Sam is aiming to take, you know, one-fifth to one-third of your life's work.
Yeah.
At the end of the day. And so if your goal is to build a legacy for your kids, make their lives easier than your life was, then this is just one more hurdle to add to that.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, you'll never tax your way to prosperity.
That's right.
Yeah. I think the flawed philosophy is, you know, we've created this flawed mindset that, oh, well, they're rich or they're this, or, you know, the rich are pompous and they're selfish. I've been around the wealthy. I've been around people that have nothing. I've been around everyone in between. And the highest income earning people, the self-made people, the business owners, some of those generous, some of the most giving, some of the most philanthropic people I've ever met. And at the end of the day, you know, like, they're the ones who create the jobs. They're the ones who stimulate the economy. They're the ones who are doing. And we're creating this, like you said, this social warfare mentality of it's us against them.
And business owners already pay the most tax out of anyone.
By far. Like, it's no comparison. And so, you know, everyone's thinking, oh, well, I'm going to get ahead because we're going to take from here, we're going to take from there. But no one is getting ahead who's at, you know, the lower income, middle income level. It's just keeping everyone, and it's forcing more people down to the lower income levels instead. I mean, because pretty soon, 50, 60, 70 grand a year is not even enough to live on.
Yep.
And so that's where I think that, you know, the like you said, it's moving towards a socialist mindset in this country. And there's nothing to me scarier than that type of shift in our entire way of being. You know, because again, I'm a product of capitalism.
Sure.
Worked 20 years to, you know, finally start really making really good money and worked my ass off. You know, and to have that taxed away or taken away and squandered by our government is one of the most disheartening things I've seen.
That's why I'm a firm believer, Brandon. The only way forward is for us to reduce taxes, which will allow businesses to spur growth, mm-hmm. and create more jobs, more opportunity. And at the same time, we need to reduce and wind down the size of our government, our 100%. Federal government. You know, that's the only way forward to yeah. regain stability and strength in the U.S. government and for every American.
Yeah, I don't care which side of the fence you're on. That
exactly.
benefits everybody.
It does.
So, speaking of benefiting everybody, obviously I want you to tell people, you know, where to find you. You know, Garrett Norton, East Point Wealth Advisors, you know, where are you located, best way to look you up, best way
sure.
to contact you, schedule an appointment. I can tell you from experience, I had money in some of the big names, you know, Edward Jones and some of the other companies like that, that was just sitting there getting fees, you know, charged every month, and the money wasn't ever growing. I was putting money in every month, but I could have put that money in a savings account and it would have got the same end result over the last 20 years. As soon as I moved the cash over to you, 10-12% every month. Like, it was starting to just immediately, even when the economy was struggling the last couple of years. So, you know, I can say from experience, like, I saw a huge increase, and I'm getting ready to move some more. But, you know, I had left in life insurance and other investments over. So, where can people find you, and what will be the process of setting an appointment if they want to meet with you?
Sure, Brandon. I'm happy you set up the shameless plug for me.
So, I gotta get it.
I own and operate East Point Wealth Advisors here in Baton Rouge, soon to be St. George. And, you know, as I said, I'm located right where Highland and Seguin meet. So my office is 13061 Great Turn Ave. You can look me up on Google. The best way to set up an appointment, though, since I don't take walk-ins, is actually by calling my office line. So that's 225-364-3966. Again, 225.
Put that in the comments.
364-3966. And so, you know, you can either schedule a call on my website or just pick up the phone and give me a call. I won't bite, unless that's what you're into.
Just joking. What's your website?
It's my website is epwai.com, and right. you can see everything you would need to see on my website.
Yeah. No, awesome. Like I said, brilliant young man, and if you want to see your money grow, and if, you know, God forbid we see taxes go up any higher than they already are, you need some tax strategy and some tax planning. And so that's another big value with Garrett and East Point Wealth Advisors is the tax strategy.
Sure. And, you know, that ties into my clientele. You know, Brandon, I mostly work with business owners, corporate retirees, and I also do a lot of estate planning. So, you know, nonprofits, corporate accounts,
yeah.
and trusts make up a huge portion of my practice, you know, acting as the advisor and investment manager for those trusts and, you know, putting financial plans in place. That's really what I always lead with is financial planning. So, you know, my business is 100% advisory. I'm a fiduciary, and you know, I take a different approach than what you'll find at some of these other you know, firms where they're trying to sell you on a high commission mutual fund or some life insurance product. That's not my MO. Yeah. So,
well, you've even gone deeper into my own like finances. Like, okay, we need to cut back on some of the cars. You know, no shame there. It's a fact. You know, like we could invest this $5,000 a month. We can, you know, cut this. We've gone in. You know, what interest rate is your house at? What are you paying on this? Like every, but like actually like going in and restructuring and budgeting better.
Sure. And then that also ties in to my review process as well, Brandon. Yeah. You know, after I take on a client and onboard a client, it's not just a one and done where you might get a phone call from me once a year, like some advisors. No, I meet with my clients 1 to 2 times a year, and we do an in-depth review of their financial picture. I update their financial plan and make any changes that are necessary in their portfolio. And so, you know, it's all one cohesive unit. Yeah. And I always lead with financial planning because everyone's financial picture is different.
Absolutely.
And so, you know, the devil's in the details.
Yeah. Well, and it can change even with the economy or your business, you know, could be going up or down. So your financial picture could change year to year. And like you said, you might have to adjust that strategy. So, yeah. Thank you for coming on with me this evening. I thank all you guys for tuning in every week. I love talking with you. It's a wealth of knowledge, and again, so much insight as to where the economy's going and what things to invest in. That's the other thing. We didn't even get into that. You guys can have a one-on-one and really figure out where to put your money and get the most growth and the best bang for your buck. So thanks again for coming on.
Thanks so much for having me, Brandon. It's been a blast.
Always. And
I look forward to the next time.
Yeah, absolutely. There will definitely be another time. Thank you guys. Tune in next week for more Financial Fitness.